Funding for Think comes from SMU's Informal Courses for Adults.
You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does the 2,000-mile divide between the United States and Mexico shape the lives of the people who live on either side, and how do those people shape the culture of the border? We have two guests with us this hour to share their expert opinions on the topic, and we hope to hear from you as well. Benjamin Heber Johnson is Associate Professor of History at SMU and author of the text for the book Border Town, The Odyssey of an American Place, which features photographs by Jeffrey Guskey. Luis Alberto Rea is Professor of Creative Writing at the University of Illinois Chicago. He has published poetry, novels, most recently The Hummingbird's Daughter, and the Pulitzer Prize-nominated nonfiction book The Devil's Highway. This afternoon at 4, he will give the Gartner Honors Lecture on the SMU campus. Gentlemen, welcome to Think.
Thanks.
Thank you.
How is the border as it exists today different from what the Americans who drew it following the Mexican War might have expected?
Well, it's really interesting to read the first reports of those surveyors because their expectation was that the border was the sort of temporary halting point for the inevitable and irresistible spread of Anglo-Saxon civilization and Anglo-Saxons, and that the people who lived there at the time in the 1840s, you know, Hispanics and Indians, were going to vanish probably sooner rather than later and be replaced by white farmers who might move down into the rest of northern Mexico, perhaps all of Latin America. And so to read that in light of, in light of all the discussion about Latino migration to the United States today is really profoundly ironic.
Why is it, Luis, that hope and despair both seem to be magnified along the border?
I think because it's, I think the fundamental decision about a border is it a gap that divides two nations, or is it a suture that unites two nations? And so it grows to, I think, represent dread and hope at the same time for both cultures on either side. Certainly if you go in Mexico, they have spent a lot of time rejecting the border as not really Mexico. And one of the brilliant moves that Vicente Fox did, bringing the Coca-Cola business plan to the Mexican government, was to see the borderland as a zone of opportunity, not a zone of alienation and shame, and generating so much finance. But clearly, it's a magnet for people who are in dire straits, wanting to get close to the United States, not always necessarily to cross, but to be near us to get some of our radiation, some of our cast off. Mm-hmm. And I think on this side of the border, it's probably, from what I can tell from the thousands of people I've spoken to on the world's longest and most endless tour, a sense of dread and worry about invasion and about cultural influence and so forth. Yet, if you go into the south of Mexico, you will hear arguments that to me are hilarious. They sound like Lou Dobbs or someone about those darn Central Americans coming.
We don't want the Guatemalans invading Mexico.
Oh, no. Those Hondurans are coming into our country, and they're getting a good education. They're taking our health care. They're taking our jobs. They're subverting our culture. They don't speak the proper Spanish. You can even hear on some of those talk shows calls to build a wall. Let's build a wall in the south of Mexico, which is, to me, it's oddly – you were talking about irony earlier, Ben. It's one of the great ironies, I think.
Well, I would add that what's interesting also, I think, about the border, Luis, you talked about it being both something that can suture together two countries and two nations and something that can divide them, is that, it can be those things at the same time and to different people. And so one of the most compelling stories I've encountered as a historian of the border is what happens in the decade after it's drawn. It's drawn on a military map by American generals and U.S. diplomats and Mexican government officials. But in the decade after it's drawn, in Texas, you have this group of people who they weren't even thinking about when they drew that border, which are the 30% of the Texas population who were enslaved, forget Canada and following the drinking gourd. There was this country, Mexico, which most Americans don't realize outlawed slavery about 40 years before the United States had. They start fleeing south to Mexico in huge numbers. Texas slaveholders are, pulling their hair out. And at the same time, in the northeast of Mexico, people living on haciendas and debt peonage and, really semi-slavery, even though it wasn't, you know, racial like it was in the United States, start fleeing in huge numbers into Texas and the rest of the United States and totally restructure wage rates and, you know, employment and agriculture in the north and the northeast of Mexico. So, you know, from its beginning, I think the aspirations of ordinary people and their sense that they could find chances for opportunity and dignity on the other side that might be denied to them where they are also ends up structuring the border. So, it, you know, it means different things to different people.
I want to talk a little bit about media portrayals and what the pictures that we see of the border, either in the news or in movies and novels and things like that. It does seem very often that either they focus on one of two things, either that the border has always been a place of conflict and struggle. There's always been you know, smuggling issues and different problems. Or people will say the border has historically been a place where people sort of got along and coexisted. And only now are we really running into problems. And I'm wondering if either one of you has any perspective on why those two opinions tend to be so different from each other when, just like the border uniting and dividing, they might actually coexist.
Well, you know, I don't understand the media portrayals, to tell you the truth, and I'm not a media person or expert. I'm sure my colleagues in the journalism department might be made nervous by this, but to me, it's such an easy sort of irresistible storyline, right? About squalor, about out of control immigration, about the drug trade. That it's a kind of pat storyline, and the truth is that compared with the rest of the United States, you know, most communities along the border are impoverished, and I think, you know, a lot of Americans have trouble looking at poverty and not seeing it as anything other than squalor and vice.
I once on these journeys had it pointed out to me that most of the major cities of the world are not on a border with another nation. They're usually inland from the border on a coast. And it's an odd feature of our border with Mexico that there are several major cities all across the United States border side that are echoed by cities on the Mexican side. And I think, you know, that constant clash and friction and partnership, they go on both at the same time. And I think, you know, those portraits you get of the border are bred of those things. There's a competition and a partnership. And I don't know that we always hear about the partnership. You know, how many people go to Tijuana, how much shopping money comes north from Tijuana, or, you know, go to Sonoita, Sonora, a place where there's nothing. And there's, I think, $4 billion, I believe, in shopping money yearly coming up out of Mexico, not undocumented money, but just shoppers. There's a huge interdependence along that line. And I think that's interesting. And I also think, you know, we're talking about media stuff. I always feel that the phrase I like to use is that there's inflammation and no information. It's easy to have talking points and it's easy to have sort of markers for myths and legends that we have. But I never hear really serious discussion, right or left, about actual numbers, actual laws, actual legislation. Nobody talks about federal law about immigration. I don't think most Americans even know what is the immigration law. What is it? Where do I find it? No one's charting the numbers, the immigrant numbers, which are falling across the board. There's only one sector that I know of this year of the Border Patrol that's up, and that's Del Mar, California. It's up 7%, but across the board, the numbers crossing are down. That's interesting stuff. And, you know, I think when we have positions, we often tailor our message to bolster our positions. And I'm trying to teach myself to pay attention to what the actual paradigm is and report honestly on that, whether I like the message or not, which is a hard job.
I think another good example of a story that the popular press often attributes to the border but probably shouldn't is the question of drug trade and drug traffic. You know, it's true a lot of the drugs entering the United States come from, you know, come across the border either from Mexico or through Mexico. A lot of them actually are indigenously grown. We've gotten quite adept at that as well. They used to come mostly through Florida before the DEA did a really good job of shutting down those sea shipping lanes. But what you don't see in those reports, who will go to Nuevo Laredo where there has been a lot of terrible drug-related violence is to talk about why they're coming through the border, where they're going, and why they're going through the places on the border that they are. So, for example, the reason why – one of the main reasons why Laredo and Nuevo Laredo are plagued with so much drug violence is not that the people who live there are more likely to be involved in these kind of things than anywhere else. It's that it sits on the I-35 corridor and it goes right to places like Dallas, where there are a lot of people who want to buy drugs that their government has outlawed. And so at the same time, the border ends up bearing disproportionately some of the costs of this trade, of this underground economy. And then simultaneously, because it's so visible there, it gets blamed for them instead of people actually talking about some of the underlying causes.
Let's go back for a minute to the immigration issue. Ben, how historically has the U.S. government treated people? Once we drew that line in 1848, what status did we confer on the people who used to be living in Mexico and then they were living in this place called the Republic of Texas and then suddenly they were in the United States?
Well, the treaty with Mexico that established the border did grant citizenship to all formerly Mexican nationals who lived in the United States. And of course, as we would expect, in some places the rights and prerogatives of that citizenship were honored, and in other places they weren't. And, you know, particularly for reasons of racial discrimination, people were treated poorly in the United States. I don't think that's too much of a shock to anyone these days. But the United States, interestingly enough, has not really been interested in stopping Mexican migration or really concerned with Mexican migration at all until well into the 20th century. And to the extent that the United States before, say, the 1920s was concerned, the federal government was concerned about immigration from Mexico, it was actually other people who were barred entry to the United States, particularly Asians. You know, Chinese were excluded starting in 1882. And this is another one of the wonderful ironies, I think, of border history, is that it used to be if you were a person from China trying to come into the United States across the U.S.-Mexican border, which many, many did, the smugglers who were helping you would teach you a couple of words of Spanish and dress you up to look as much like a working-class Mexican as possible. And so you would then try to resemble exactly the kind of migrant who today the United States is the most intent on trying to keep out. So there have been radical changes over the course of the border's history in terms of U.S. enforcement on that line.
Is it possible, Luis, do you think, to live close to the border on either side and ever lose sight of the fact that you are either north or south of the border? Or is that something that is always in the backs of the minds of people who live there?
I don't know. You know, I was born in Tijuana to an American mom. I was an American citizen born abroad, and my dad was Mexican, and I had no concept of the border. Nobody in my family was, quote, illegal. You know, we just went back and forth, and I think it just seemed like a neighborhoods of the same city to me. You know, the paradigm certainly has shifted. You don't have to tell people in Dallas that there are a lot of Latinos, Mexicans, Central Americans living here traditionally and more perhaps in the last couple of decades. But, you know, the opposite thing is happening in Mexico, certainly in northern Baja California. There's a huge population of North Americans going down there to settle, retirees and so forth. And there's going to be over 1 million before the decade's out.
We could have immigration problems the other direction.
Maybe.
Luis Alberto Rea is here. He's professor of creative writing at the University of Illinois Chicago. He's in town to give a lecture at SMU this afternoon. Also with us is Ben Johnson, associate professor of history at SMU. His new book is called Border Town: The Odyssey of an American Place. We'll return to our discussion in a moment. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about how the U.S.-Mexico border shapes life on both sides with Luis Alberto Rea, who's a professor of creative writing at the University of Illinois Chicago and author of multiple books about the border, including The Devil's Highway, which was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. Also, Benjamin Heber Johnson is here. He's associate professor of history at SMU. His new book is called Border Town, The Odyssey of an American Place, and that features photographs by Jeffrey Gusky. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. This came up a little bit before. The border has been called an artificial dividing line. There are people on both sides, and they've always been there, and you know, any sort of political border is put in place. Has it been long enough now, though, that the division is not so artificial anymore, that it really is something really changes fundamentally once you go to one side or the other?
I think so. I mean, it's you know, obvious that we're different nations. We have different political parties, political systems, different modes of law. Mexico enjoys Napoleonic law. We don't. I think those divisions magnify and intensify as time goes on. Ben was talking about some of these patterns of immigration. You know, the first iteration of what we know of as the Border Patrol was the anti-Chinese expeditionary force. It was a cavalry to pursue Chinese workers. And if you look at the old times in our history, our concern as a government and a people was about Irish people, German people, Italian people coming over and over again. And it was very late that this issue started to come up. I think that perhaps it was intensified by a couple of things. The Bracero program, certainly, when the Asian workforce in the West was put in camps, somebody had to get the produce. And we enacted a huge program to mobilize Mexican workers to come in. But as the war ended, we had to get rid of them. And we enacted Operation Wetback, official government phrase, to throw people out. Earlier than that, you know, President Cárdenas nationalized all the petroleum things in Mexico and cast out all these gas and oil companies. So the levels, I think, of distrust and competition between the two governments, I think, are profound and exacerbated and focused perhaps by that border. But what you see, I think, on the border is a much more holistic and organic relationship between the two cultures. You were mentioning during the break that you're from El Paso, and El Paso has a completely different paradigm than a lot of people would think, I think, you know, between Juarez and El Paso.
Yeah, it's funny. When I think about the border, I really think my first image is the bridge, which is the connection between El Paso and Juarez,
right,
as opposed to, I think, people in a lot of other parts of the country, and particularly even in Texas, think about the wall or the divisions that exist.
Yeah, I agree with Luis. I mean, I think it has come to mean something really profound to be on one side of the border or on another, even though there still are these connections. There certainly are. I think another reason why it's come to mean so much is the question of national identity. And, you know, particularly over the course of the 20th century, I think there's been more and more of Hispanics have found more and more of a place for themselves in American life and the American dream, you know, even if they're living right on the border and speaking Spanish. And so one of the things I found, is really interesting about this town, Roma, Texas. That's the focus of my new book. Is since the Civil War, there were Union and Confederate soldiers from that town in the Civil War and in every American war since then. So people have, you know, the question of national identity is one that doesn't fall along these sort of racial and ethnic lines. And of course, people in Latin America understand that the term Mexican is a national term. It's somebody who, you know, is from the nation of Mexico. In the United States, the term Mexican is a racial term.
It's somebody who is racially
Mexican. And yet, you know, we in the United States have opened up in our life, you know, to be an American is not to be white, right, anymore. So a question of national identity also runs through these things, even though there are these continued cross-border connections.
And you have to, I think about that. I mean, you look at me, you know, often when I go to readings and people don't know who's coming up, they're expecting a traditional black-haired, black-mustached Mexican guy. And, you know, Bubba Jr. gets up with looking, you know, blue eyes and light hair. But, you know, perhaps the opposite of what you're saying it holds true in Mexico too, that Mexico has opened its understanding of what does it mean to be a Mexican, you know, because there are a lot of people in Mexico, a lot of racial groups, a lot of ethnicities in the mix. Mexico's a melting pot too, and I think there's a kind of a sense of it being a monumental presence. You know, we are all down there a certain way. It's hard for me because I'm both American and Mexican by upbringing. And when I say we, I think of all of us together. And I have to remind myself, oh, no, we're sifted out a certain way. But if you look in my family, you know, Urrea is actually a Basque word. It means men of gold. My family, the consul general here is my cousin, Enrique Hubbard Urrea. My grandma's name was Guadalupe Murray. So we have a very huge mix. We have Wongs in our family who are Chinese in Mexico City.
And I would add that the U.S., the name of the U.S. ambassador in Mexico City is Garza.
Yeah, right.
At the same time, right?
Right, exactly. And, you know, I think this issue of identity is fascinating and vexes us on either side of the fence, you know. When I was working on Devil's Highway, I clearly ended up very close to a lot of Border Patrol agents, which I didn't expect. And they used to joke with me. They'd say, you know, hey, buddy, if we're such racists, how come I'm married to a Mexican woman, huh? And when I asked one of the Mexican consuls, well, why do these guys marry Mexican women? She said, it's because they know what's good.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Luke asks, Ben, if you would talk about the impact of prohibition and its repeal on border communities.
Sure. I mean, to the extent that today many people associate the Mexican border with the vice trade, then that really goes back to prohibition because Mexico was not run by Protestants who wanted to try to ban the consumption of alcohol. And so that was one place where you could you know, you could go across and get alcohol. And so even then, by the 1920s, for example, this has become sort of a more general association. And there's this term, Tijuana Bibles, which meant pornography, but making really viscerally that sort of association with the border and vice. But one of the things we've forgotten is that for a lot of Americans, particularly in certain regions of the country, that association was actually made with Canada because Canada also did not have prohibition. So there was some sort of, you know, sensual lure of Canadian border towns, which I think is, you know, totally dropped out of the American imagination by now.
Yeah, and I think the other side of that coin, again, as always, is what did the United States, you know, ship into Mexico as sort of samizdat information. And certainly one of the things the Mexican oligarchy wisely tried to stop was rock music. And the United States injected rock music into Mexico, and the ripples are still being felt. You know, a whole new culture of pro-democracy, humanistic activity because of the very dangerous effect of people like Jim Morrison, you know, and John Lennon. So, again, it's a flow of services. It's a flow of information. I think it's a flow of culture back and forth, back and forth. And this paradigm shifts constantly, I believe. And, you know, for example, in the question of immigration, you're seeing the paradigm shifting right before your eyes, except we're not being shown it, so it's not before our eyes. But if you research into the numbers, as the numbers of crossers diminish, as the numbers of dollars being remitted back to Mexico diminish, then you go to the sources and start asking what's going on. You see a whole, I think, different picture starting to develop. You know, there was a report earlier this summer. You can get it on the internet if you Google it, but immigration into Mexico from the south has dropped 50% this year, which will directly, of course, affect what happens on our border to the north of Mexico. The numbers, for example, in the region that I wrote about in the Devil's Highway are down 68%. It's very interesting. So the paradigm is shifting. I don't know what it means. I'm not, you know, neither am I a political expert nor a sociologist or even an economist, but I'm watching these trends shift. And I think we are often presented with monumental pictures on both sides of the border. This is what it's like. This is what happens. This is the truth, when it's often a fluid thing, and it does tend to change and shift.
Is there as much interest within Mexico for deconstructing what it means to live on the border on one side or the other as there is for people in this country? I'm even thinking, Ben, of your book, which takes this border city and looks at it and examines it. And I haven't seen a lot of images, and I don't read Spanish particularly well, but I haven't seen a lot of images generated from within Mexico that really explore the border.
Well, you know, I think this is an interesting issue. Part of the crisis of the border is that though the numbers are going down, the death numbers are not going down. So percentage-wise, the death numbers are growing even though they're staying. It's getting more dangerous. And the information flow has been dictated, as far as I can tell, by folklore and word of mouth. And so when you say, well, Tio Pepe made this trip and he was okay, that was 3 years ago. And it's shifting so rapidly that 3 years ago no longer is a safe passage. That's all interesting to me. There's a kind of a resistance to, I think, media representations of what's going on in the border. For example, my experience with my book, we were talking about this at lunch, that they're trying to make a film of it, but the Mexican government film commission would not give the director, who's a young Mexican director, any money because they rejected the notion of Americans rescuing Mexicans. They said, we will never finance a film where Americans in helicopters save dying Mexicans. And he said, but this is historically what happened in this story. And the film commission man said, I don't care what history says. We don't show that. You know, so I think there's a cultural pride, a political position to take. That's changing bit by bit. It's changing through again, rock music, rap music. It's changing through word of mouth. It's changing because everybody is linked now in ways you wouldn't believe. For example, and I'll pass it over to Ben, but at the Tijuana garbage dump where I used to do missionary work for many years and have a lot of friends, there's an internet cafe outside of the garbage dump. And the garbage pickers themselves are illiterate, but their children, for whom these parents picked garbage, went to school, learned to read and write, learned to use computers, and now go on YouTube, the Drudge Report, wherever they want to go, they're on it on the internet. So you're finding the flow of information, the cascade of information is pouring into Mexico. Bloggers, videos, LiveLeak, YouTube, Metacafe, all these places people can see stuff for themselves. So I think the information is starting to spread. And one of the only reasons we wanted to do a movie was so that people who didn't read books certainly like to go to the cinema. And if they could graphically see how dangerous it is, it would make an impression on them, we hope, and make them at least think twice about what the journey might entail for them.
Yeah, I think in both countries there's a larger sort of reconsideration, even at the sort of highest levels of kind of formal culture of what the border means. So it was really interesting, I think, to see this in both Mexico and the United States. So, for example, somebody like Bruce Springsteen in the 1990s starts singing songs about Tijuana and Matamoros. And in some ways, they're the same songs he's always sung, right? These are about people, their sufferings, their yearnings, their families, their struggles, the dignity of ordinary people. You know, the American novelist Cormac McCarthy moved from Appalachia to El Paso and started writing these great borderlands epics. Similarly, in Mexico, Carlos Fuentes, perhaps the greatest living Mexican novelist, you know, set a Rashomon kind of novel largely on the border and in different places in the U.S. and Mexico. And, you know, the government now, which has traditionally just, you know, looked down on northern Mexicans as the most agringado, you know, the most Americanized and, you know, perhaps even to the point of not really being Mexican, has started to support northern Mexican universities better, even collecting literature and folklore of the Mexican north. So I think in some ways both countries are realizing that, you know, our shared borderlands are actually a really important part of who we are as countries, and we ought to, you know, understand and respect that and view that as a serious subject of the kind of art and literature that helps explain to ourselves who we are.
Oddly enough, there's a great – I've been calling it a renaissance, but I realize it's a naissance because there was no re about it. But there's a great flowering of music and literature coming out of the border region, certainly of, you know, the California to – far western Arizona areas, out of all places, Tijuana and Mexicali, poets, fiction writers, critics, musicians. And there's this amazing sort of techno group called the Nortec Collective who are doing amazing music, who have spawned a literary movement and a visual art movement, which is just an incredible thing to see. And that's heartening to me. I've often said after all these years, again, you know, starting out as a Tijuana border boy myself, being a missionary, being an educator, being a writer, I've looked at and tried everything. You know, religion has had a long time to work on the border, and it's thwarted, and politics have been thwarted, and business models have been thwarted. And sometimes I feel like the only thing left to try is art, as weak as art may be. And that's what I am trying to do, to use what little art I have to try to illuminate this thing and maybe, as you mentioned earlier, bridges, you know, put up bridges and see what happens. I think that the secret message for me after all these years is to realize that the border is not just a patrolled fence between Mexico and the United States. There are borders everywhere. All you have to do is go to one of my talks and you'll see a border between black and white, male and female, gay and straight, right and left. We have millions of borders, and I think one of the things that makes the Mexican border so vivid to us is it's the most obvious representation.
So we all understand what a division is, and then we look at the Mexican border, U.S.-Mexican border, and that becomes sort of the symbol for all of that.
Yeah. I mean, we look at the border fence, say, in Israel between Palestinians and Israelis, and it is very vivid to us. And I think ours is just as vivid if we really look at it. We understand what it is because we see it every day.
Luis Alberto Rea is in town for a lecture that he'll give this afternoon at 4 at the Hughes Trigg Theater on the SMU campus. Also with us this afternoon is Ben Johnson. He is an SMU-based historian and author. We'll return to our conversation in just a moment. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about how the U.S.-Mexico border shapes life on both sides with Benjamin Heber Johnson, who's Associate Professor of History at SMU and the author of Border Town, The Odyssey of an American Place. Also with us is Luis Alberto Urrea. He's a professor of creative writing at the University of Illinois, Chicago. He has written multiple books, including the Pulitzer Prize-nominated The Devil's Highway, which is being made into a film. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Melissa in Dallas. Hello, Melissa.
Yes.
Hi.
Hi. My comment is regarding the paradigms that exist in the U.S. For example, my husband is from Mexico City, and he's of Spanish background. He's blonde and green-eyed, and I'm very fair-skinned and also Spanish descent, and we get constantly asked if we're where we are from. And people are surprised when we say Mexico because the accent is unfamiliar to the Spanglish they're used to hearing, and they were not aware that there are blonde natives in Mexico, and that's just funny. And it seems that Mexicans take more advantage of the benefits of becoming bicultural than Americans do.
That's an interesting point.
My comment.
Thanks so much for your call.
Thank you.
Yeah, people used to think I was French. They would call me Louis because they just couldn't imagine, you know, that was possible.
Well, Mexico is still a place, though, isn't it, that's coming to terms with what it means to be mestizo or what it means to be of European descent. For a long time, there was sort of an advantage assumed to people who were of pure Spanish blood.
Yeah. They used to call those malinchistas, you know, people who identify with La Malinche, Cortez's translator. I mean, it's not lost on me that my family tends to be like your caller's family, you know, blue-eyed or green-eyed or light-haired or red-haired. And many of that, my father, I think in the 40s, kind of rode that appearance up into quite high governmental service in Mexico. That was true. But I think, you know, Mexico in a lot of ways is tormented by the indigenous / conquistador past in ways that the United States has managed to bury or shove aside. And so it seems to me that those issues of mestizaje, indigenous blood, all that is something that's evolving all the time, and but always present, always present.
And of course, you know, in their own way, these issues are playing out in the United States. It's estimated by about 2050, about a quarter of the United States is going to be of Latino descent. And so, you know, questions of the border for many people are going to be family, you know, are going to be their own family history. So, you know, again, both nations seem to be dealing with some similar questions. How do you have a cohesive sense of a national identity that's not actually based narrowly on one ethnic group, you know, to the exclusion of others?
I think it's an important question. I think it fuels some of the, I think, sense of almost panic that people feel. You know, what does this mean about my country? Is the United States going to be the United States any longer? And, you know, you hear certainly on radio fears of the North American Union. People are always afraid of that. It's going to be a Mexico, North America, Canada, some sort of common market situation instead of a sovereign United States. And I think those are important questions that Mexico itself asks. I think any nation asks itself these questions. Witness the immigration panics in Spain. You know, people coming from northern Africa invading Spain, and they're being shot at.
What's striking to me about those panics and about people worrying about the culture, and by 2050, 25% of Americans will be of Latino descent, is that no one seems to consider that it might mean something different at that point, something different from what we know now, to be of Latino heritage. You know, you talked earlier, Luis, about people being afraid that the Irish and Italians were coming to this country en masse. And now, at this point in history, people don't necessarily make a judgment about who you are or what you'll be based on having an Irish or a Latino surname. I mean, Italian surname.
Ben Franklin didn't want those Germans or those Pennsylvania Dutch.
They're going to ruin everything.
The Pennsylvania Dutch were really a problem. And, you know, I imagine that people who make a living talking about this on the radio would be delighted if massive waves of Pennsylvania Dutch people came over here instead of, you know, I don't know. Sometimes I think what would happen if the map were reversed and we were psychologically on the bottom and South America were on the top? What would that mean? You know, I just think there's kind of almost a mythological terror of shadowy critters coming up through the bottom and sneaking in. And that is a primal fear. And, you know, I was joking with you a little bit during the break that I felt that the Mexican border is now up around St. Paul, you know, Minneapolis, St. Paul. You go places that has never seen Spanish-speaking folks and they're living there now. You know, go to Arkansas and you see in the hills of Arkansas Pentecostal evangelical temples for Mexicans. That's got to really do a number on the longtime residents of that town. So I can imagine how odd it must be.
For me, this is one of the real challenges of trying to write about the border, because on the one hand, there is a public audience for it precisely because of the kind of debates and controversies that we're alluding to. And yet on the other hand, I at least am kind of reluctant to sort of enter that arena on the terms that are set for it. And there's really very little in our new book about border policy, and at no point do we purport to come out and have the answers for border enforcement. And, you know, one of the things that struck me about using Luis's book, The Devil's Highway, in my classes is that it deals with some of the effects of border policy, but it's about the human experiences involved and sort of trying to get readers to put themselves in the shoes of people that are you know, that are involved in crossing and involved in enforcement and things like that. But at the same time, I do think that the more people actually learn about the sort of hidden history of the border and the more kind of humanized it can be, right? And this is the work of art in some sense, is to humanize questions that, for me at least, what I take away from that is a is a greater sense of sort of confidence that these issues are going to work themselves out. In fact, people on the border have been dealing with these questions for decades and generations before they have in the rest of the United States. And there are places of beauty and grace and cultural melting that we're beginning now to see in the rest of the country. And so in some sense, I think, you know, all of this may work end up working out surprisingly well for both countries.
Yeah. One of the Border Patrol agents said to me, if you want to understand what's going on here, follow the money. Someone is making a lot of money on either side of the border, and it's not us, the Border Patrol, and it's not these people we're catching. Somebody else is making a lot of money. And, you know, I was really impressed. It's hard because those guys aren't free to speak unless you're out in the desert somewhere and no one's listening, because they are vulnerable. But to realize that this issue affects them. It's not just, you know, I went into it because I've always written about the poor. I've always written about my mission work I used to do. And I was very interested in the suffering of the lost walkers dying in the desert. But it didn't occur to me that this kind of thing has a massive effect on law enforcement, on consular corps, on all these levels of people along the border who feel that they're part of a mystery world that the rest of us don't know. They honestly, and I think it's true, you'll find that people even 100 miles away from the border have no real concept of what's going on both sides. I always joke that people assume that Mexicans have an illegal immigration organ, you know, and at about 13 it starts pumping illegal immigration hormones and everybody just knows automatically what to do. It's not true. People don't know down in Guadalajara, just like people don't know in Ames, Iowa, what's going on the border. So part of this whole system, I think, is an education process. That's, again, why I harp on, you know, lots of inflammation, no information. I would like to see information for both sides. I always am urging a bipartisan, binational sort of 9/11 commission on the immigration paradigm. But I think the immigration paradigm is shifting by itself in a way. And so I think the next one is going to be the narco war, personally. My take is that what seems to be happening on the border is a transformation now to real hardcore armed conflict with this new business that's taking over.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Scott in Dallas. Hello, Scott.
Hi. I have a comment going back to what one of your guests mentioned earlier about the border towns being associated with vice. And it's regarding one of my favorite films, which is an Orson Welles film starring Charlton Heston. It's called The Touch of Evil. And it's always been, to me, just a completely bizarre social commentary on the border and what it's all about. And I'm wondering if your guests are familiar with that film or could compare that to, you know, something more modern like the film Traffic, which really deals more with modern issues of the border. And that's my question / comment.
Thanks for your call.
Scott, that was great. It's odd to me that Touch of Evil and Traffic, you know, they seem like relatives to me because in some ways you think, wow, things haven't changed. I love both films, actually. I'll tell you, if you're interested in this, the Vice portrait, there's a book, a novel, ostensibly a mystery novel. It's called The Power of the Dog, by a guy named Don Winslow, and it's a deeply disturbing, epic portrait of corruption and so forth on the border and what it really means. And I actually asked some sheriffs I know along the border to read it to see if this guy was crazy or not, and they came back to me and said basically, I don't know where he gets his information, but this book is dead on, which scared the daylights out of me, much like I think Touch of Evil must have scared people when they saw it. You should read that book and see what you think. It's unbelievable. Just be forewarned, it's very dark.
I'm also a big fan of Touch of Evil, and I think, you know, there have been some recent really excellent border movies too, made like Tommy Lee Jones, The Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada, Lone Star by John Sayles. So this is going to continue to be the subject for a lot of great Hollywood flicks.
I guess you have to be careful whose interpretation you accept, though. And
yeah,
movies seem to have more power very often than anything else.
Yeah, they you know, people who do recovery work have this little phrase, we're only as sick as our secrets. And I think because the border region is perforce a secretive, shadowy place, a lot of very questionable stuff starts to happen out of public view.
We have time briefly for one final call from Gerardo in Allen. Hi, Gerardo.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to say real quick, when I was doing mortgages before the bottom fell out, I was trying to get a guy qualified who lived in Juarez. He's a U.S. citizen, and he had his car lot where he did his business in El Paso. And I could not get the underwriter to understand that people actually do live that way. Mm. And it was difficult because they couldn't even conceive of anybody crossing the border and even working on either side.
So they didn't understand people do that every day.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And the thing about it is people can't even apply daily life concepts to what happens on the border, much less these more complicated ideas like immigration. And I don't know. It seems to me that we're so ignorant of history. I mean, we are doomed to repeat it because I know about all the Bracero programs and all the mass deportations that happened around World War II and all that because some of our relatives were involved with that. So, mm-hmm. I mean, it's just one of those things where I think if people apply just a little supply and demand, they can really account for a lot of what happens. You know, you mentioned that concept to follow the money. Well, it comes back down to money, people, supply and demand.
Thank you so much for your call.
All right, thanks.
Well, yeah, you know, it may be that a lot of people don't understand that about the border, and yet there's a good reason why they should, because in some ways it's not just the border, but it's the larger situation of the United States now. And, you know, this word gets tossed around a lot, but globalization. On the one hand, we are our own country. We have our own government. We have certain national security needs, certain interests of sovereignty. On the other hand, we're deeply tied to the rest of the world. It would be foolish to pretend otherwise. Many people living here come from the rest of the world. Most of us buy and sell products every day that come from across the globe. And so in this sense, the dilemmas of the border, that is something that distinguishes who we are and who they are on the other side, and yet also something that connects us to the rest of the world, is really a central metaphor for what it's like to be an American in the 21st century.
15-second final thought, Luis.
I'll tell you what one of the Mexican consuls said to me, and I didn't put it in my book because I thought it would damage his career, but he said, you people act like we are an enforced enema coming into your country when, in fact, your country is an industrial vacuum cleaner. And what your country needs is workers and people to put money into Social Security, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Very interesting perspective. You can see Luis Alberto Urrea speak this afternoon at 4 on the SMU campus. That's the Gartner Honors Lecture. Benjamin Heber Johnson is Associate Professor of History at SMU. His new book is called Border Town, The Odyssey of an American Place. Guys, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.